This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The TV version of this show airs on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The upcoming U.S. presidential election has revealed a deep split within the electorate that has confounded many of us. Why would so many working-class whites line up behind a billionaire to vote against their own interests? Author Thomas Frank asked that important question over a decade ago with his seminal book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Inspired by Frank's book, acclaimed sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild set out to address the political polarization of working and middle-class Americans in her new book. It's called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. Russell Hochschild left her self-described bubble of Berkeley, California, to meet with and attempt to understand poor and conservative Americans in Louisiana. She now joins me to share what she found. Arlie Russell Hochschild is a professor emerita in the sociology department at the University of California, Berkeley, author of 9 books, winner of the Ulysses Medal and Guggenheim and Mellon Grants, and her new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, has just been named a finalist for the National Book Award. Welcome to the program, Arlie.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Congratulations on the attention your book is receiving. Let's first talk about how this all started. What was it that motivated you to go to Louisiana, to leave Berkeley, and to try to understand what it is that motivates a lot of poor conservatives? Why was this an important issue for you?
Yes, well, I think it was an important issue for a lot of people. Already back in 2011, left and right were being torn apart, not really talking to each other, solidifying each of us, each side, and Congress was at a standstill. So I realized that I was in a kind of a schizophrenia like everybody else, that I lived in an enclave, a geographic enclave, a media enclave, a technological enclave, so that when I talked to my partner and good friends, neighbors, everybody agreed with me. But when I opened the newspaper and looked at television, I thought, whoa, there is another world, another truth out there, another enclave. So I decided 5 years ago to get out of my political bubble here in Berkeley, California, and find a bubble just as far right as we are left, turn off my political alarm system, and really try to climb an empathy wall into the world of people with whom I had such profound differences. And it was an amazing experience. I began with the Thomas Frank kind of red state paradox. How could the red states that are poorer, have worse education, worse health, lower life expectancies, and who take more money from the federal government in aid than they give in taxes, also be the most opposed to the federal government? If you need help with your problems, wouldn't you welcome some help? So that was the paradox. And I discovered that Louisiana was that place that was as far away from Berkeley as it could be. Lake Charles in specific, a petrochemical center of development, that it was like a super red paradox, because Louisiana in 2014 was the poorest state. 44% of its state budget came from the federal government, and yet it was heavily Tea Party and now is big time for Donald Trump. So it seemed like an exaggeration of the very thing I needed to get out of my world to go and try and understand.
So you went to Louisiana, to the Louisiana Bayou. What were the kinds of people that you met with? I mean, there are a lot of African Americans in Louisiana too, particularly in the cities, the well-known cities like New Orleans. But did you try to find mostly white conservatives?
Yes, I went where the growth of the right wing has been the most, and that is in the South, that's in the Deep South. It is among whites, it's among older whites, it's among religious older whites. So Southern Louisiana, older religious rights, I thought, was just the group that I wanted to focus on. And overall, I talked to 60 people for the 5 years, but 40 of them were very ardently Tea Party and now Trump, and they were white. I interviewed a lot of blacks, but they're not the core group.
Right. So what was it that you found were their main concerns? Before we get into why they might hold their political views, tell us what has impacted them personally. These are obviously poor folks. So we might imagine that, say, poor liberals might have some of the same concerns regarding poverty, lack of access to education, et cetera, employment, et cetera, right?
Yes, you would think. And in fact, once I did climb that empathy wall, I did discover that there were a lot of points on which we really share common grounds. But I'll give you an example. I met a man named Mike Schaff, who was born on a former sugar plantation. He took me to that plantation and pointed where his house used to be. He was the fifth of seven children of a Cajun plumber that serviced the plantation and off the plantation. So he kind of grew up in the Old South, and then he spent his adulthood in the New South. That is to say, he's always worked for oil, kind of the new plantation there. And so this was his background. He was now in his 60s, looking forward to retirement, and wanted to be on the bayou and do some fishing. And he loved fishing. He loved nature. So he worked at a job, very little vacation for the first 5 years at his present place of employment. He got 1 week off for 5 years, a year, 1 week off a year. That's sick time and vacation together. The next 5 years, it was 2 weeks, sick time and vacation together. So he never could get out on that bayou to do the fishing, and he loved nature. Okay, when I first talked to him about this red state paradox, he knew about it. Yeah, we're poor state, that's not good.
So you were pretty open about your politics when you talked to a lot of the folks you interviewed and what your goal was?
Absolutely. I'd say my name is Arlie Hochschild. I'm a retired sociology professor at UC Berkeley. I live in a political bubble. I'm worried about this divide. I'd like to come here and understand how you see the world inside your political bubble. Would that be okay? And he, when he first met me, he said, "Oh, you're from Berkeley, California. You must be communist, right?" And so I laughed. Luckily, he laughed. It was a joke. Okay, then we can talk here. And then he said, "Oh, the people around here in the bayous are very, very conservative. Me, I'm Tea Party, but you've got a lot of Cajun, very conservative, very Republican people here." I thought, oh, perfect. So you know, introduce me to your neighbors. I'd like to. This is exactly the world I want to understand. So he was terrific. He took me to where he'd been born, where he'd gone to school, Catholic school, and where his parents were buried. And then here, and all the while, a conversation. And I was realizing that the red state paradox, really, he knew about it, of course, but didn't matter. Something else mattered more, and that was his distrust of the government. First, he said that the government can't, it takes away community, and he was a big community guy. He loved his neighbors in the bayou, and he thought government would come in with its services and a helping hand and start doing things for people that they should do for each other. That was his first thing to say. But what happened to him is that actually it turned out to be the absence of government that robbed him, ultimately, of his community. Because on this bayou, it's called Bayou Corn. Now it's called Bayou Corn Sinkhole. And it's in the lower reaches of the loops of the Mississippi River before it empties into the Gulf of Mexico. And there was a drilling accident where a drill bore down into the floor of the bayou, broke open an underlying salt dome formation, and it was like pulling actually plug on from a bathtub, and you know, ancient cypress trees crashed down, and methane drenched mud replaced this pristine wetland forest. So it was terrible. There was 360 people were evacuated. He lost his neighbors, he'd lost his community. And I said to him, well, look, you were against the government, and even against regulation of industry. That's something government should do, I would think. And wouldn't, aren't you mad at industry for doing this? And why are you against the government helping you? It would have preserved the community you so treasure. And the conversation, you know, what was great about it, we went out fishing and talked. Me mainly just wanting to get how he was thinking. And what it came down to is that he saw the government first as an instrument of the North. He was very, you know, felt like the North, Washington, D.C., was always wagging its moral fingers and telling Southerners that they're wrong in how they think. And he saw the federal government as like the state Louisiana government, which indeed is a servant to the oil industry and does not protect the people. In fact, its regulatory agencies don't regulate, don't protect the people. They are dysfunctional, in truth. He was right about that. But what he didn't have the same analysis of it that I did, that actually the oil companies had required that the state do its moral dirty work for it. Now, when I put it that way, he agreed.
Now, you also point out that another person that you met, that you write about in your book, a woman named Madonna Massey, a gospel singer who loved Rush Limbaugh, she felt that Limbaugh was defending her against insults that she felt liberals were lobbing at her. Quote, "Oh, liberals think that Bible-believing Southerners are ignorant, backward, rednecks, losers. They think we're racist, sexist, homophobic, and maybe fat," end of quote. Arlie, do you feel that a lot of this disconnect that the left has from the right, when we're talking about ordinary Americans, not the wealthy, has to do with pride? Is there a sense of pride that makes particularly older white Americans feel that they're being constantly judged by the left?
That's what they mean by PC. This I kept hearing in all my interviews. They felt extremely culturally colonized and looked down upon. And you know what Madonna Massey and Mike Shepp, and really all the people I came to know there, felt is what I came to think of as a deep story, that under politics, right-wing and progressive, there's a deep story, and part of this deep story really touches on pride, as you've said. What is a deep story? It's a story that of life as it feels like, right? So you take facts out of the deep story, you take moral judgments out of the deep story, and you're just left with how things feel. And for those two and others I got to know, it feels like you're waiting in line for a much prized reward at the top of a hill. It's like a pilgrimage. And that's the American dream. And you're waiting for it, but the line is not moving and hasn't for a while. Your feet are tired. You have no malice toward anyone, but you just want that reward because you have worked hard. And you are down on pride. You feel you're being ignored. Then you see line cutters who seem to cut in line and push you back. Who are they? Well, affirmative action blacks who now have access to jobs that used to be reserved for whites. Even more so, affirmative action women who have access Jobs used to be reserved for men, and then you have immigrants and refugees.
And of course, the reality doesn't fit in, right? They are perceived as line cutters, but in truth, being a white male in the U.S. still brings you the most privilege than probably any other demographic.
Well, this is what's really interesting. And I said in the deep story, we're taking facts out, right, and moral judgments out, is how it feels to them. And what they feel, and this is the important part that the empathy wall, you know, is the highest on. They don't feel like a guy like a Mike Shep doesn't feel like being a man has helped him because his wife earns more, a lot of women earn more. He hasn't had a raise in 2 decades. His job wasn't that steady. He had to work his way through college at quite difficult jobs, kind of putting down boards in the swamp, mosquitoes around him, you know, to build an oil platform in the water. So he doesn't feel like being white or being man, that those privileges have trickled down to him as much as left people presume that all whites and all men have, you know, represent the pinnacle of power.
Right.
So there's a different, in the deep story, it feels different. These categories have different experiential reference,
right.
You know. So it goes like that, And then feel like the federal government has sponsored, in the deep story, has sponsored the line cutters and is an instrument of their own marginalization. That's something they share as a feeling.
Right. And so sadly, of course, those of us who are looking at the facts or whose own personal experience, you know, as people of color or poor people who might be progressive, we have our own stories and we just can't relate to what, say, a conservative poor white person in Louisiana has or what they're going through. It seems like facts don't seem to really play a role. I mean, presenting some of these folks with facts doesn't seem to matter. And I'm wondering if you think that the ascension of President Obama as the first black president, as somebody with a one parent who was an immigrant, seemed to symbolize all of these things that and feelings of resentment from white conservatives? And is that one reason why, at least over the past 8 years, we've seen a widening of this gulf, this political gulf between two spectrum ends of the spectrum?
Yes, I think that's true. And the paradox is there are actually a lot of parallels here. And I guess the point of my book, the direction in which I would like it to make the reader go, is to search out those parallels, to not otherize the right and think, oh, you're evil, you're impossibly racist, you're against me, but to actually get in a boat and go fishing with. You know, your own Mike Shep. And I think you would discover that he feels like a minority group too. And he has not had an easy life, nor have the other people I talked to.
Right. And finally, Arlie, do you feel that the
racist, he doesn't feel racist at all and feels falsely accused and incensed that this would be presumed of him.
And then finally, do you feel that the fact that our failed economy, that maybe you and I agree is the natural outcome of capitalism that has screwed over in the 99% of Americans, that addressing that first and foremost, so that people like Mike Shep don't feel left behind, could help bridge this divide? I don't know, you know, how, you know, it does feel like Republicans and Democrats, at least mainstream and establishment Democrats, do leave all of us behind.
Yes, well, I think that's exactly right. I feel that underneath both the right wing and left wing deep stories our potential strategies for dealing with the same scary face of globalization, and in which there's high degree of automation, offshoring, importation of foreign labor. That's right, they're living with that right there in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Those big companies are not offering them a lot of jobs. And so poor whites are kind of left out, actually. And Filipina pipe fitters are being imported in for Sasol, for example, a big South African petrochemical company right there. Their response to capital, to global capital, is this. It's to say, okay, we're not going to win. There's nothing we can do to turn the beast around. So we're going to get on bended knee and say, please come, please invest here in Southwest Louisiana. We will lower corporate taxes. We will wink at protective regulation. And please come here. And as for public sector, no, we're just going to wrap ourselves around the church and family and get our sustenance from that. And those public dollars that would have gone to a great school or a great park, no, we're going to take those to supplement our wage, which we know global capital is going to take away from it. It's kind of an adaptive strategy and saying, well, you know, we're giving in to neoliberal capitalism.
Well, Arlie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, helping bridge this divide through your book. Good luck to you with the book.
Okay, thank you.
My guest is Arlie Russell Hochschild, Professor Emerita in the Sociology Department at the University of California in Berkeley, author of 9 books, winner of the Ulysses Medal and Guggenheim and Mellon Grants. We've been talking about her latest book, which has just been nominated for a National Book Award. It's called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter, twitter.com/R. Are you with Sonali?